This is tape 12 of John Howie's Biographia Scoticana, or The Scots Worthies, the 1781 edition narrated by Larry Berger with assistance from Lynn Hopewell. This work is available from Stillwater's Revival Books, along with a treasure trove of the finest Protestant, Reformed, and Puritan literature available anywhere in the world today. Stillwater's may be reached at area code 780-450-3730 or by email at swrb@swrb.com. Stillwater's website is www.swrb.com and contains numerous free books and articles. Please note that these tapes are not copyrighted, and we therefore encourage you to copy and distribute them to any and all you believe would be benefited. We continue our reading of The Life of Mr. James Mitchell. 2 days after the sentence, orders came from court for placing Mr. Mitchell's head and hands on some public place of the city, but the sentence being passed, no alteration could be made, and if Sharp had any hand in this, he missed his end in design. About the same time, his wife petitioned the council that her husband might be reprieved for some time, that she might be in case to see and take her last farewell of him, especially as it was not above 12 days since she was delivered of a child, and presently affected with a fever. But no regard was paid to this. The sentence must be executed. While he was in prison, he emitted a most faithful and large testimony. In the first place, testifying against all profanity. Then he gives the cause of his suffering, in the words of Elijah, 1 Kings 19:14, "I have been very zealous for the Lord of hosts," and so forth. He adheres to the covenanted work of reformation and the covenant, approves of Lex Rex, which was written by Samuel Rutherford, the causes of God's wrath, apologetical relation, naphtali, jus populi, and so forth. Afterwards, he speaks of magistracy in these words, "I believe magistracy to be an ordinance and appointment of God, as well under the New Testament as it was under the Old, and that whosoever resisteth the lawful magistrate in the exercise of his lawful power, resisteth the ordinance and appointment of God," Romans 13:1 and so forth, 1 Peter 2:13, Deuteronomy 17:15, and so on. The lawful magistrate must be a man qualified according to God's appointment, and not according to the people's lust and pleasure, lest in the end he should prove to them a prince of Sodom and governor of Gomorrah, whom God, in his righteousness, should appoint for their judgment and establish for their correction, and so on. Then he comes to be most explicit in testifying against the givers and receivers of the indulgence as an encroachment on Christ's crown and prerogative royal, and so on. Protests before God, angels, and men against all acts made anywise derogative to the work of God and reformation. Likewise, protests against all banishments, imprisoning, finings, and confinements that the people of God have been put to these years by past, describing the woeful state and condition of malignants and all the enemies of Jesus Christ. And in the last place speaks very fervently anent his own sufferings, state, and condition, which he begins to express in these words, "Now if the Lord, in his wise and overruling providence, bring me to the close of my pilgrimage, to the full enjoyment of my long-looked-for and desired happiness, let him take his own way and time in bringing me to it. And in the meantime, O thou my soul, sing thou this song, spring thou up, O well of thy happiness and salvation, of thy eternal hope and consolation. And whilst thou art burdened with this clog of clay and tabernacle, dig thou deep in it by faith, hope, and charity, and with all the instruments that God hath given thee. Dig in it by precepts and promises, dig carefully and dig continually, ay, and until thou come to the source and head of the fountain himself, from whence the water of life floweth. Dig until thou come to the assembly of the firstborn, where this song is most suitably sung, to the praise and glory of the rich grace and mercy of the fountain of life," and so forth. And a little farther, when speaking of his mortification to the world and other sweet experiences, he says, "And although, O Lord, thou shouldst send me in the back track and tenor of my life to seek my soul's comfort and encouragement from them, yet I have no cause to complain of hard dealing from thy hand, seeing it is thy ordinary way with some of thy people." Psalm 42:6, "O God, my soul is cast down in me from the land of Jordan and the hill Hermon," and so forth. Yea, though last he brought me to the banqueting house and made love his banner over me, among the cold highland hills beside Kippen, November 1673, he remembered his former loving kindness towards me, But withal he spoke in mine ear that there was a tempestuous storm to meet me in the face, which I behoved to go through in the strength of that provision, 1 Kings 19:7. Then, after the reciting of several scriptures as comforting to him in his sufferings, he comes at last to conclude with these words, "And seeing I have not preferred nor fought after mine own things, but thine honor and glory, the good liberty and safety of thy church and people, although it be now misconstructed by many, yet I hope that thou, Lord, wilt make thy light to break forth as the morning, and my righteousness as the noonday, and that shame and darkness shall cover all who are enemies to my righteous cause. For thou, O Lord, art the shield of my head, and sword of my excellency, and mine enemies shall be found liars, and shall be subdued. Amen, yea, and amen." Sic subscribetur, James Mitchell. Accordingly, upon the 18th of January, he was taken to the grass market of Edinburgh, and the sentence put in execution. In the morning he delivered some copies of what he had to say, if permitted, at his death, but not having liberty to deliver this part of his vindicatory speech to the people, he threw it over the scaffold, the substance of which was as follows. "Christian people, it being rumored abroad immediately after I received my sentence that I would not have liberty to speak in this place, I have not troubled myself to prepare any formal discourse on account of the pretended crime for which I am accused and sentenced. Neither did I think it very necessary, the fame of the process having gone so much abroad, what by a former indictment given me near 4 years ago, the diet of which was suffered to desert, in respect the late advocate could not find a just way to reach me with the extrajudicial confession they opponed to me. All knew he was zealous in it, yet my charity to him is such that he would not suffer that unwarrantable zeal so far to blind him as to overstretch the laws of the land beyond their due limits, in prejudice of the life of a native subject. Next, by an extreme inquiry of torture, and then by exiling me to the Bass, and then, after all, by giving me a new indictment at the instance of the new advocate, who before was one of mine when I received the first indictment, to which new indictment and debate in the process I refer you, and particularly to these two defenses of an extrajudicial confession and the promise of life given to me by the Chancellor upon his own and the public faith of the kingdom. Upon the verity thereof I am content to die, and ready to lay down my life, and hope your charity to me, a dying man, will be such as not to mistrust me therein, especially since it is notoriously adminiculate, and in Scottish law adminiculate means to support by corroborative evidence, it is notoriously adminiculate by an act of secret council, and yet denied upon oath by the principal officers of state present in council at the making of said act, and whom the act bears to have been present. The Duke of Lauderdale, being then His Majesty's Commissioner, was likewise present, and which act of council was, by the Lords of Justiciary, most unjustly repelled, and so forth. Thus much for a short account of the affair for which I am unjustly brought to this place, but I acknowledge my private and particular sins have been such as have deserved a worse death to me, but I hope in the merits of Jesus Christ to be freed from the eternal punishment due to me for sin. I am confident that God doth not plead with me in this place for my private and particular sins, but I am brought here that the work of God may be made manifest, and for the trial of faith, John 9:13, 1 Peter 1:7, that I might be a witness for his despised truths and interest in this land, where I am called to seal the same with my blood. And I wish heartily that this my poor life may put an end to the persecution of the true members of Christ in this place, so much actuated by these perfidious prelates, in opposition to whom, and testimony to the cause of Christ, I at this time lay down my life, and bless God that he hath thought me so much worthy as to do the same, for his glory and interest. Finally, concerning a Christian duty, in a singular and extraordinary case, and anent my particular judgment, concerning both church and state, it is evidently declared and manifested elsewhere. Farewell all earthly enjoyments, and welcome Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, into whose hands I commit my spirit. James Mitchell. Here we have heard the end of the zealous and faithful Mr. James Mitchell, who, beyond all doubt, was a most pious man, notwithstanding all the foul aspersions that have been or will be cast upon him, not only by malignant prelates, but even by the high flyers or more corrupted part of the Presbyterian persuasion, namely on account of his firing at Bishop Sharp, which they think is enough to explode, affront, or bespatter all the faithful contendings of the true Reformed and Covenanted Church of Scotland. But in this, Mr. Mitchell stands in need of little or no vindication, for by this time the reader may perceive that he looked upon himself as in a state of war, and that, as Sharp was doubtless one of the chief instigators of the tyranny, bloodshed, and oppression in that dismal period, he therefore, no doubt, thought he had a right to take every opportunity of cutting him off, especially as all the ways of common justice were blocked up. Yet all this opens no door for every private person at their own hand to execute justice on an open offender, where there is access to a lawful magistrate appointed for that end. Yea, what he himself saith anent this affair, in a letter dated February 1674, may be sufficient to stop the mouths of all that have or may oppose the same, a few words of which may be subjoined to this narrative, where, after he has resumed, that is, summarized, what passed betwixt him and the Chancellor, he says that as to his design against Sharp, quote, he looked upon him to be the main instigator of all the oppression and bloodshed of his brethren that followed thereupon, and of the continual pursuing of his life, and he, being a soldier, not having laid down arms, but being still upon his own defense, and having no other end or quarrel at any man but what, according to his apprehension of him, may be understood by the many thousands of the faithful, besides the prosecution of the ends of the same covenant, which was and is in that point the overthrow of prelates and prelacy, and he being a declared enemy to him on that account, and he to him in like manner, and as he was always to take his advantage, as it appeared, so he took of him any opportunity that offered. For, says he, I, by his instigation, being excluded from all grace and favor, thought it my duty to pursue him at all occasions, and so forth. And a little farther he instances in Deuteronomy 13:19, where the seducer or enticer to a false worship is to be put to death, and that by the hand of the witness, whereof he was one. Takes notice of Phinehas, Elijah, and so forth, and then observes that the bishops would say what they did was by law and authority, but what he did was contrary to both. But he answers, the king himself and all the estates of the land and so forth both were and are obliged by the oath of God upon them to extirpate the perjured prelates and prelacy, and in doing thereof to have defended one another with their lives and fortunes and so forth. And that's referring to the wording of the Solemn League and Covenant. The life of Mr. John Wellwood. Mr. John Wellwood, born about the year 1649, was son to Mr. James Wellwood, sometime minister at Tindergirth, and brother to Mr. Andrew Wellwood and James Wellwood, doctor of medicine at London. After he had gone through the ordinary courses of learning, he entered on the ministry, and afterwards preached in many places, but we do not hear that he was ever settled minister in any parish, it being then a time when all who intended any honesty or faithfulness in testifying against the sins and defections of the times were thrust out of the church and prosecuted with the greatest extremity. It is said that he preached some 5 or 6 sermons in the parish where his father was a minister, which were blessed with more discernible effects of good amongst the people than all the diligent painfulness his father had exercised in the time he was minister of that parish. And besides his singular piety and faithfulness in preaching, he was a most fervent presser to all the duties of the Christian life, particularly to the setting up and keeping of fellowship and society meetings for prayer and Christian conference, which he often frequented himself. One time, among several others, at the new house in Livingston Parish, after the night was far spent, he said, "Let one pray, and be short, that we may win to our apartments before it be light." It was the turn of one who exceeded many in gifts. But before he ended, it was daylight within the house. After prayer, he, Mr. Wellwood, said, "James, James, your gifts have the start of your graces." And to the rest he said, "Be advised, all of you, not to follow him," that is, the man who prayed, "in all times and in all things, otherwise there will be many ins and many outs in your tract and walk." In the year 1677 there was an Erastian meeting of the actually indulged and non-indulged, procured by the indulged and their favorites, in order to get unity made and kept up, but rather in reality a conspiracy without any truth, unity, or veracity among these backsliders and false prophets. Mr. Wellwood, worthy Mr. Cameron, and another minister were called before this meeting in order to have them deposed and their license taken from them, for their faithfulness in preaching up separation from the actually indulged. But they declined their authority as being no lawful judicatory of Jesus Christ, while thus made up of those who were actually indulged. Some of them went to Mr. Hogg, who was then in town, though not at this meeting, for his advice anent them, to whom he said, "His name is Wellwood, but if ye take that unhappy course to depose them, he will perhaps turn out their Torwood at last." Mr. Wellwood was a man of lean and tender body. He always slept, ate, and drank but little, as being one still under a deep exercise, the state and case of his soul laying a great concern upon his spirit about the defections and tyranny of that day, especially concerning the indulged and so many pleading in their favor. But being of a sickly constitution before, he turned more melancholy and tender. Much about this time he was informed against to the managers at Edinburgh that having intruded upon the Kirk of Tarbolton in the Shire of Ayr, the council appointed Glencairn and Lord Ross to see that he be turned out and apprehended, but there is nothing further can be learned anent this order. One Sabbath, when he was going to preach, and the tent set up for him, the laird on whose ground it was caused lift it, and set it on another laird's ground. But when Mr. Wellwood saw it, he said, "In a short time that laird shall not have one fur of land." Some quarreled him for saying this laird being then a great professor. He said, "Let alone a little, and he will turn out in his own colors." Shortly after this he fell out in adultery, and became most miserable and contemptible, being, as was said, one of York's 4-pound papists. In the beginning of the year 1679, he said to William Nicholson, a Fifeshire man, "Ye shall have a brave summer of the gospel this year, and for your further encouragement, an old man or woman, for very age, may yet live to see the bishops down, and yet the church not delivered. But ere all be done, we will get a few faithful ministers in Scotland to hear. But keep still amongst the faithful poor mourning remnant that is for God, for there is a cloud coming on the Church of Scotland, the like of which was never heard, for the most part will turn to defection. But I see on the other side of it the Church's delivery with ministers and Christians, that you would be ashamed to open a mouth before them." Among his last public days of preaching, he preached at Bolter Hall in Fife, upon that text, "Not many noble," and so forth. Here he wished that all the Lord's people, whom he had placed in stations of distinction, there and everywhere, would express their thankfulness that the words "not many" were not any, and that the whole of them were not excluded. In the end of that sermon he said, pointing to St. Andrew's, "If that unhappy prelate Sharp die the death of all men, God never spoke by me." The bishop had a servant who, upon liberty from his master on Saturday's night, went to visit his brother, who was a servant to a gentleman near Bolter Hall, the bishop ordering him to be home on Sabbath night. He went with the laird and his brother that day. Mr. Wellwood noticed him with the bishop's livery on, and when sermon was ended, he desired him to stand up, for he had somewhat to say to him. "I desire you," said he, "before all these witnesses, when thou goest home, to tell thy master that his treachery, tyranny, and wicked life are near an end, and his death shall be both sudden, surprising, and bloody. And as he hath thirsted after and shed the blood of the saints, he shall not go to his grave in peace," and so forth. The youth went home, and at supper the bishop asked him if he had been at a conventicle. He said he was. He asked what his text was and what he said. The man told him several things, and particularly the above message from Mr. Wellwood. The bishop made sport of it. But his wife said, "I advise you to take more notice of that, for I hear that these men's words are not vain words." Shortly after this he went to Perth, and there lodged in the house of one John Barclay. His bodily weakness increasing, he was laid aside from serving his master in public, and lingered under a consumptive distemper until the beginning of April 1679, when he died. During the time of his sickness, while he was able to speak, he laid himself out to do good to souls. None but such as were looked upon to be friends to the persecuted cause knew that he was in town, and his practice was to call them in, one family after another, at different times, and discourse to them about their spiritual state. His conversation was both convincing, edifying, and confirming. Many came to visit him, and among the rest one Aiton, younger of Inchdarney in Fife, a pious youth about 18 years of age, and giving Mr. Wellwood an account of the great tyranny and wickedness of Prelate Sharp, Mr. Wellwood said, you will shortly be quit of him, and he will get a sudden and sharp off-going, and ye will be the first that will take the good news of his death to heaven, which literally came to pass the May following. About the same time he said to another who came to visit him, quote, that many of the Lord's people should be in arms that summer for the defense of the gospel, but he was fully persuaded that they would work no deliverance, and that after the fall of that party, the public standard of the gospel should fall for some time, so that there would not be a true faithful minister in Scotland excepting two, unto whom they could resort, to hear or converse with, anent the state of the church. And they would also seal the testimony with their blood, and that after this there should be a dreadful defection and apostasy, but God would pour out his wrath upon the enemies of his church and people, wherein many of the Lord's people, who had made defection from his way, should fall among the rest in this common calamity. But this stroke, he thought, would not be long, and upon the back thereof there would be the most glorious deliverance and reformation that ever was in Britain, wherein the church should never be troubled any more with prelacy. When drawing near his end, in conversation with some friends, he used frequently to communicate his own exercise and experience with the assurance he had obtained of his interest in Christ. He said, I have no more doubt of my interest in Christ than if I were in heaven already. At another time he said, although I have been for some weeks without sensible comforting presence, yet I have not the least doubt of my interest in Christ. I have oftentimes endeavored to pick a hole in my interest, but I cannot get it done. That morning, ere he died, when he observed the light of the day, he said, now eternal light, and no more night and darkness to me. And that night he exchanged a weakly body, a wicked world, and a weary life, for an immortal crown of glory, in that heavenly inheritance which is prepared and reserved for such as him. The night after his exit, his corpse was removed from John Barclay's house into a private room belonging to one Janet Hutton, till his friends might consult about his funeral, that so he might not be put to trouble for concealing him. It was quickly spread abroad that an intercommuned preacher was dead in town, upon which the magistrates ordered a messenger to go and arrest the corpse. They lay there that night, and the next day a considerable number of his friends in Fife, in good order, came to town in order to his burial, but the magistrates would not suffer him to be interred at Perth, but ordered the town militia to be raised, and imprisoned John Bryce, boxmaster or treasurer to the guildry, for refusing to give out the militia's arms. However, the magistrates gave his friends leave to carry his corpse out of town, and bury them without their precincts, where they pleased. But any of the townspeople who were observed to accompany the funeral were imprisoned. After they were gone out of town, his friends sent two men before them to Drone, 4 miles from Perth, to prepare a grave in that churchyard. The men went to Mr. Pitcairn, the minister there, one of the old resolutioners, and desired the keys of the churchyard that they might dig a grave for the corpse of Mr. Wellwood, but he refused to give them. They went over the churchyard dike and digged a grave, and there the corpse was interred. There appears to be only one of his sermons in print, said to be preached in Bogle's Hole in Clydesdale, upon 1 Peter 4:18, the text being, "And if the righteous scarcely be saved," and so forth. There are also some of his religious letters written to his godly friends and acquaintances yet extant in manuscript, but we are not to expect to meet with anything considerable of the writings of Mr. John Wellwood or the succeeding worthies. And no wonder, seeing that in such a broken state of the church, they were still upon their watch, haunted and hurried, from place to place, without the least time or conveniency for writing. Yea, and oftentimes what little fragments they had collected fell into the hands of false friends and enemies, and were by them either destroyed or lost. The Life of William Gordon of Earlston. William Gordon of Earlston was born about the year blank. He doesn't give us the year. He was son to that famous reformer, Alexander Gordon of Earlston, and was lineally descended of that famous Alexander Gordon, who entertained the followers of John Wycliffe, and who had a New Testament of the vulgar tongue which they used to read in their meetings at the wood, near Airds, beside Earlston. William Gordon, having thus the advantage of a very religious education, began very early to follow Christ. As early as the year 1637, Mr. Rutherford, in a letter, admonishes him thus, Sir, lay the foundation thus, and ye shall not soon shrink nor be shaken. Make tight work at the bottom, and your ship shall ride against all storms. if with all your anchor be fastened on good ground, I mean, within the veil, and so on. And indeed, by the blessing of God, he began very early to distinguish himself for piety and religion with a firm attachment to the Presbyterian interest and a covenanted work of reformation, in which he continued steadfast and unmovable until he lost his life in the honorable cause. What hand he had in the public affairs during Cromwell's usurpation I cannot so well say, but we must suppose him upon the remonstrator's side. But the first public testimony he gave after the restoration of Charles II, recorded in history, was about the year 1663, when some commissioners were appointed by the council to go south and inquire anent some opposition that was then made by the people to the settlement of curates at Kirkcudbright in Irongray. And the said commissioners, knowing this worthy gentleman's firmness to the Presbyterian principles, and being designed either to make him comply in settling an episcopal incumbent in the parish of Dalry in Galloway, where, by the once established laws, he had some right in presenting, or if he refused to concur with the bishop, which they had all reason imaginable to suspect he would, to bring him to further trouble. Accordingly, they wrote him a letter in the following tenor. Finding the Church of Dalry to be one of those that the bishop hath presented, an actual minister, Mr. George Henry, fit and qualified for the charge, and that the gentleman is to come to your parish this Sabbath next to preach to that people, and that you are a person of special interest there, we do require you to cause his edict to be served, and the congregation to convene and countenance him, so as to be encouraged to prosecute his ministry in that place. Your loving friends and servants, Linlithgow, Galloway, Annandale, Drumlanerk. To this letter, Earlston gave them a very respectful return, showing upon solid reasons why he could not comply with this their unjust demand, as the following excerpt from that letter evidences. I ever judged it safest to obey God and stand at a distance from whatsoever doth not tend to God's glory and the edification of the souls of his scattered people, of which that congregation is a part. And besides, my lords, it is known to many that I pretend to lay claim to the right of patronage of that parish, and have already determined therein with the consent of the people to a truly worthy and qualified person, that he may be admitted to exercise his gifts amongst that people. And for me to countenance the bearer of your lordship's letter were to procure me most impiously and dishonorably to wrong the majesty of God, and violently to take away the Christian liberty of his afflicted people, and enervate my own right, and so forth. And how, he says in a footnote, here observe that though this worthy gentleman mentions the right of patronage, yet it is with this proviso and limitation, the choice or consent of the people. Otherwise, says he, it would wrong the majesty of God, take away the Christian liberty of the people, and invalidate his own right. And how unlike is this to the species of patronage and claims of patrons at this time, when nothing but absolute power and arbitrary measures will satisfy them. Returning to the text, this was, without question, what the managers wanted, and so his trouble began, for on the 30th of July following, quote, the Lords of Council order letters to be directed to charge William Gordon of Earlston to compeer before them to answer for his seditious and factious carriage, close quote. That was his refusing to comply with prelacy and hear the curates, and for his favoring and hearing the outed ministers. And further, November 24th, same year, quote, the council being informed that the Laird of Earlston kept conventicles and private meetings in his house, do order letters to be directed against him to compeer before this council to answer for his contempt under the pain of rebellion, close quote. But all this no ways dashed the courage of this confessor of Christ in adhering to his persecuted and despised gospel, which made these malignant enemies yet pass a more severe and rigorous act against him, in which it was exhibited that he had been at several conventicles, as they were pleased to call the preachings of the gospel, where Mr. Gabriel Semple, a deposed minister, did preach in the Corsack Wood and Wood of Airds, and heard texts of Scripture explained both in his mother's and in his own house by outed ministers, quote, and being required to enact himself to abstain from all such meetings in time coming, and to live peaceably and orderly, conform to law, close quote, he refused to do the same. They did, therefore, order the said William Gordon of Earlston to be banished, and depart forth of the kingdom within a month, and not to return under the pain of death, and that he live peaceably during that time under the penalty of 10,000 pounds, or otherwise to enter in his person in prison. Here it would appear that he did not obey this sentence, and although we have little or no particular account of his sufferings, yet we are assured he endured a series of hardships. In the year 1667 he was turned out of his house and all, and the said house made a garrison for Bannatyne, that wicked wretch and his party, after which almost every year produced him new troubles, until the 22nd or 23rd of January, 1679, that he emerged out of all his troubles and arrived at the haven of rest, and obtained his glorious reward in the following manner. Having some affairs to settle, perhaps on a view never to return, he could not join that suffering handful who were then in arms near Bothwell. He sent his son, who was in the action, he himself hastening forward as soon as possible to their assistance, and not knowing of their disaster, was met near the place by a party of English dragoons who were in quest of the sufferers, and, like another valiant champion of Christ, he refused to surrender or comply with their demand, and so they killed him straight out upon the spot. And how he says in the footnote, his son Alexander Gordon here narrowly escaped being taken by means of one of his tenants, who, knowing him as he rode through Hamilton, made him dismount, put on a woman's clothes, and rock the cradle. After this he went over to his brother-in-law, Mr. Hamilton, to represent the low case of the United Societies to the churches of the Netherlands. He was by them called home, and when returning back a second time, he was apprehended by the enemy and put to the torture, but by means of his friend, the Duke of Gordon, his life was spared. However, he was sent to the Bass, and from thence, I suppose, to Blackness, where from 1683 he continued till he was liberated at the Revolution. It is to be lamented that neither he, after this, nor his son, Sir Thomas, fully followed the steps of their ancestors. Returning to the text, his son being out of the way, and his friends not obtaining that his body should be earned amongst the bones of his ancestors, he was interred in the churchyard of Glasford, and though a pillar or monument was erected over his grave, yet no inscription was got inscribed because of the severity of these times. Thus fell a renowned Gordon, one whose character at present I am in no capacity to describe, only I may venture to say that he was a gentleman of good parts and endowments, a man devoted unto religion and godliness, and a prime supporter of the Presbyterian interest in that part of the country wherein he lived. The Gordons have all along made no small figure in our Scottish history, but here was a patriot, a good Christian, a confessor, and I may add, a martyr of Jesus Christ. The Lives of Messrs. John Kidd and John King. Messrs. John Kidd and John King suffered many hardships during the persecuting period, namely from the year 1670 to the time of their martyrdom, 1679. Mr. King was sometime chaplain to Lord Cardross, and it appears he was apprehended and imprisoned in the year 1674, but got out on a bond and surety for 5,000 merks to appear when called. Next year he was again, by a party of the persecutors, apprehended in the said Lord Cardross's, but was immediately rescued from their hands by some country people who had profited much by his ministry. After this he was taken a third time by Bloody Claverhouse near Hamilton with about 17 others, and brought to Evandale, where they were all rescued by their suffering brethren at Drumclog, after which he and Mr. Kidd were of great service, and preached often among the honest party of our sufferers, till their defeat at Bothwell, or Bothell, where Mr. Kidd, among other prisoners, was taken and brought to Edinburgh. It would appear that Mr. King was apprehended also at the same time, in or west from Glasgow. And how he says in a footnote, since the publication of the above, I received the following account of the taking of Mr. King in a letter from a correspondent. Mr. King, having come to pay his respects to the Laird of Blair, in Dalry Parish, near Kilwinning, to whom formerly he had been sometime chaplain, one Bryce Blair, a farmer, who had been groom there while Mr. King was about that house, getting notice, came and desired Mr. King to pay him a visit, to which he consented. Accordingly, he went where he preached a short word on the Saturday night following. But on the Sabbath morning, a party of the enemy, according to some, Crichton's dragoons, being in quest of him and getting the scent, two of them in disguise came to an old man feeding cattle near Bryce Blair's house and asked him whether he knew where that godly minister, Mr. King, was, for they were afraid he would be taken as the enemy were in pursuit of him, and if they knew where he was, they would secure him from them. The old man, having more honesty than policy, cried out, "I'll run and tell him." Whereupon they rode full speed after him to the house. Finding a servant of the house waiting on Mr. King's and his servants' horses, they immediately dismounted, and having driven their own horses into the standing corn, threatening him not to stir from the spot on pain of death, one of them took his saddle, and putting it on Mr. King's horse, said, "Many a mile have I rode after thee, but I shall ride upon thee now." By this time the rest had surrounded the house, and Mr. King and his servant, being in bed, they immediately commanded them to rise and put on their clothes. While his servant was putting on his spurs, one of the soldiers damned him, saying, "Was he putting a spur on a prisoner?" To whom he replied he would put on what he pleased, for which he received from him a blow. Then another gave that soldier a blow, saying, "Damn you, sir, are you striking a prisoner, while making no resistance?" In the hurry, Mr. King's servant threw his master's wallies in a peat loft. Thus they were both carried off. They hired one David Cumming in the same parish to be their guide to Glasgow, who willingly consented. They pressed a horse for him to ride upon, but they had not gone far when the horse ran stark mad, and jumping and striking all around him with such violence as affrighted the beholders, they were obliged to let him go. But no sooner was he returned home than he became as calm as ever. Cumming had to go on foot to Glasgow. From thence Mr. King was sent to Edinburgh, after which his servant was set at liberty. For what afterward became of Cumming, see the appendix. That is the appendix, The Judgment and Justice of God Exemplified. And that will be on later tapes. Returning to the text, and I'll reread the sentence where we left off. It would appear that Mr. King was apprehended also at the same time in or west from Glasgow. For a party of English dragoons being there, and one of them on horseback called for some ale, and drank to the confusion of the Covenants. Another of his comrades, asking him at the Stable Green Port where he was going, he answered, "To carry King to hell." But this poor wretch had not gone far whistling and singing till his carbine accidentally went off and killed him on the spot. God shall shoot at them with an arrow, suddenly shall they be wounded. Psalm 64:7. Mr. King was taken to Edinburgh, where both he and Mr. Kidd were before the council July 9th. Mr. King confessed when examined that he was with those who rose at that time and so on. Mr. Kidd confessed he had preached in the fields, but never where there were men in arms except in two places. They signed their confession, which was afterwards produced in evidence against them before the justiciary. On the 12th, Mr. Kidd was again examined before the council and put to the torture. It seems he was more than once in the boots, where he behaved with much meekness and patience. Mr. King was examined on the 16th before the justiciary, and Mr. Kidd on the day following. On the 22nd, they received their indictments. Their trial came on upon the 28th. They were again before the justiciary, where, upon their former petition on the 24th, advocates were allowed to plead for them, but no exculpation was allowed them. When their indictments were read, the advocate produced their confessions before the council as proof against them, and accordingly they were brought in guilty and condemned to be hanged at the Market Cross of Edinburgh on Thursday, the 14th of August, and their heads and right arms to be cut off and disposed of at the council's pleasure. Accordingly, the same day the King's Act of Indemnity was published in the forenoon, and, to grace the solemnity, the two noble martyrs, who were denied a share therein, were in the afternoon brought forth to their execution. It was related by one there present that, as they approached the place, walking together hand in hand, Mr. Kidd, looking about to Mr. King with a cheerful countenance, said, "I have often heard and read of a kid sacrificed, but I seldom or never heard of a king made a sacrifice." Upon the scaffold, they appeared with a great deal of courage and serenity of mind, as was usual with the martyrs in these times, and died in much peace and joy, even a joy that none of their persecutors could intermeddle with. Their heads were cut off on another scaffold prepared for the purpose. Thus ended these two worthy ministers and martyrs of Jesus Christ, after they had owned their allegiance to Zion's King and Lord, and given a faithful testimony against popery, prelacy, Erastianism, and so on, and for the covenanted work of Reformation in its different parts and periods. The reader will find their dying testimonies in Naphtali and the Western Martyrology, page 146 and so forth. A few of their sermons I had occasion lately to publish. And Stillwaters does publish Naphtali. The Life of Mr. John Brown. Mr. Brown was ordained minister at Wamphray in Annandale. There is no certain account how long he was minister there, only it was some time before the restoration of Charles II, as appears from his great faithfulness in opposing prelacy, which was then about to be intruded upon the church, insomuch that for his fortitude and freedom with some of his neighboring ministers, for their compliance with the prelates, contrary to the promise they had given him, he was turned out of that place. Upon the 6th of November, 1662, he was brought before the council. Whether by letters to converse with the managers, or by a citation, it is not certain. But the same day, the council's act against him runs thus. Quote, Mr. John Brown of Wamphray, being convened before the council for abusing and reproaching some ministers for keeping the diocesan synod which with the Archbishop of Glasgow, calling them perjured knaves and villains, did acknowledge that he called them false knaves for so doing, because they had promised to the contrary to him. The council ordain him to be secured close prisoner in the toll booth till further orders. He remained in prison till December 21st, when, after Mr. Livingston and others had received their sentence, the council came to this conclusion anent him. Quote, upon a petition presented by Mr. John Brown, minister of Wamphray, now prisoner in Edinburgh, showing that he had been kept close prisoner these 5 weeks by past, and seeing that, by want of free air and other necessaries for maintaining his crazy body, he is in hazard to lose his life, therefore humbly desiring warrant to be put at liberty, upon caution to enter his person when he should be commanded, as the petition bears, which being at length heard and considered, the Lords of Council ordain the supplicant to be put at liberty, forth of the toll booth, he first obliging himself to remove and depart off the King's dominions and not to return without license from His Majesty and Council under pain of death. Close quote. Great were the hardships he underwent in prison, for, says a historian, he was denied even the necessaries of life, and though, because of the ill treatment he met with, he was brought almost to the gates of death, yet he could not have the benefit of the free air until he signed a bond obliging himself to a voluntary banishment, and that without any just cause. But upon the 23rd of the same month, on presenting a petition to the council to prorogue the time of his removal from the kingdom, in regard he was not able to provide himself with necessaries, and the weather so unseasonable that he could not have the opportunity of a ship, and so forth, as the petition bears, which being read and considered, quote, they grant him 2 months longer after the 11th of December bypassed, in the meantime he being peaceable, acting nothing in prejudice of the present government, and so forth, close quote. And next year he went over to Holland, then the asylum of the banished, where he lived many years, but never, that we heard of, saw his own native country any more. How he employed himself mostly in Holland, we are at a loss to say. His many elaborate pieces, both practical, argumentative, and historical, witness that he was not idle, which were either mostly wrote there, or published from thence, and particularly those concerning the indulgence, cess-paying, and so forth, sent for the support and strengthening of his persecuted brethren in the Church of Scotland, unto whom he and Mr. McWard contributed all in their power, that they might be kept straight, while laboring in the furnace of affliction, under a scene of sore oppression and bloody tyranny. But hither did their enemies yet pursue them, for the king, by the instigation of Prelate Sharp in the year 1676, wrote to the States General to remove them from their province. And although the States neither did nor could reasonably grant this demand, seeing they had got the full stress of laws in Scotland many years before, yet it appears that they were obliged to wander farther from the land of their nativity. Sometime before his death, he was admitted minister of the Scots congregation at Rotterdam, where he, with great prudence and diligence, exercised that function, it being always his study and care to gain many souls to Christ. For as he was faithful in declaring the whole counsel of God to his people, in warning them against the evils of the time, so he was likewise a great textuary, close in handling any truth he discoursed upon, and in the application most home, warm, and searching, showing himself a most skillful casuist. His sermons were not so plain but the learned might admire them, nor so learned but the plain understand them. His fellow soldier and companion in tribulation, that is, Mr. Robert McWard, gives him this testimony, quote, that the whole of his sermons, without the intermixture of any other matter, had a specialty of pure gospel tincture, breathing nothing but faith in Christ and communion with him, and so on. The ordination of faithful Mr. Richard Cameron seems to have been the last of his public employments, and his last but excellent discourse before his exit from this world, which appears to have been about the end of the year 1679, was from Jeremiah 2:35, "Behold, I will plead with thee, because thou sayest, I have not sinned," and so forth. And having finished his course with joy, he died in the Lord. Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. No doubt Mr. Brown was a man famous in his day, both for learning, faithfulness, warm zeal, and true piety. He was a notable writer, a choice and pathetical preacher. In controversy he was acute, masculine, and strong. In history, plain and comprehensive. In divinity, substantial and divine. The first he discovers in his work printed in Latin against the Socinians, and his treatise, De Causa Dei Contra Antisabbatarios, which the learned world know better than can be here described. There is also a large manuscript history entitled Apologia Pro Ecclesia and so forth in the year 1660, consisting of 1,600 pages in quarto, which he gave in to Charles Gordon, sometime minister at Dalmeny, to be by him presented to the First Free General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, and was by him exhibited to the General Assembly in the year 1692. Of this history, the apologetical relation seems to be an abridgment. His letters and other papers, particularly the history of the Indulgence, written and sent home to his native country, manifest his great and fervent zeal for the cause of Christ. And his other practical pieces, such as that on justification, on the Romans, Quakerism the pathway to paganism, the hope of glory, and Christ the way, the truth, and the life, the first and second part of his life of faith, and Enoch's testament opened up, and so on, all which evidence his solid piety and real acquaintance with God and godliness. And I would note to the listener here that Stillwaters publishes a number of these works. David Lockman, in his entry in the Dictionary of Scottish Church History and Theology, quotes James Walker as characterizing Brown as, without doubt, the most important Scottish theologian of this period. And that certainly can be seen in works like The Life of Justification Opened. While Stillwaters does publish a number of these works, they are still looking for the rest of Brown's works, he being such an important theologian from this period, and his works so edifying and learned. So if you know of any of these works that are available or of any way to make them available to Stillwaters, please contact them at the number at the end of the tape. The Life of Henry Hall of Howhead. Mr. Hall of Howhead, in the parish of Eckford in Teviotdale, having had a religious education, began very early to mind a life of holiness in all manner of godly conversation. In his younger years, he was a most zealous opposer of the public resolutions that took place in the year 1651, insomuch that when the minister of that parish complied with that course, he refused to hear him, and often went to Ancram to hear Mr. John Livingston. After the restoration of that wicked tyrant Charles II, being oppressed with the malicious persecutions of the curates and other malignants for his nonconformity, he was obliged to depart his native country and go over to the border of England in the year 1665, where he was very much renowned for his singular zeal in propagating the gospel by instructing the ignorant and procuring ministers to preach now and then among that people, who before his coming were very rude and barbarous, but now many of them became famous for piety. In the year 1666, he was taken prisoner on his way coming to Pentland to the assistance of his covenanted brethren, and imprisoned with some others in Cessford Castle. But by divine providence, he soon escaped thence, through the favor of his friend the Earl of Rossburg, the print is obscured here, who was a blood relation of his, unto whom the castle then pertained. He retired again to Northumberland, where, from this time until the year 1679, he lived, being very much beloved of all that knew him, for his care and concern in propagating the gospel of Christ in that country, insomuch that his blameless and shining conversation drew love, reverence, and esteem even from his very enemies. About the year 1678, the heat of the persecution in Scotland obliged many to wander about in Northumberland, as one Colonel Struthers was violently pursuing all Scotsmen in those places. Howhead was in that scuttle near Crookham, a village upon the English border, where one of his nearest intimates, that gallant and religious gentleman Thomas Kerr of Hayhop, fell, upon which he was obliged to return again to Scotland, where he wandered up and down in the hottest time of persecution, mostly with Mr. Donald Cargill and Mr. Richard Cameron. During which time, beside his many other Christian virtues, he signalized himself by a real zeal in defense of the persecuted gospel in the fields. He was one of these four elders of the Church of Scotland, who at the Council of War at Shawhead Muir, June 18, 1679, were chosen, with Messrs. Cargill, Douglas, King, and Barclay, to draw up the causes of the Lord's wrath against the land, which were to be the causes of a fast on the day following. He had indeed an active hand in the most part of the transactions among the Covenanters at that time, as being one of the commanding officers in that army, from the skirmish at Drumclog to their defeat at Bothell Bridge. After this, being forfeited, and diligently searched for and pursued after, to eschew the violent hands of these his indefatigable persecutors, he was forced to go over to Holland, the only refuge then of our Scots sufferers. But he had not stayed there long until his zeal for the persecuted interest of Christ and his tender sympathy for the afflicted remnant of his covenanted brethren, who were then wandering in Scotland through the desolate caves and dens of the earth, drew him home again, choosing rather to undergo the utmost efforts of persecuting fury than to live at ease in the time of Joseph's affliction, making Moses' generous choice rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy what momentary pleasures the ease of the world could afford. Nor was he very much concerned with the riches of this world, for he stood not to give his ground to hold field preachings on, when few or none else would do it, for he was still a true lover of the free and faithful preached gospel, and was always against the indulgence. And how he says in a footnote, "The Reverend Mr. George Barclay, who was very public at this time, and had his hand at many a good turn, and was a blessed instrument to the edification of many souls, but got a waft of that murdering east wind in the year 1679, said, the best days that ever he had in preaching of the gospel was in the bounds belonging to the Laird of Howhead, worthy Henry Hall, and so forth." Returning to the text, about a quarter of a year after his return from Holland, he was mostly with Mr. Cargill, lurking as privily as they could about Barrowstoness and other places on this and the other side the Frith of Forth. At last they were taken notice of by these two bloody hounds, the curates of Barrowstoness and Carradine, who soon smelled out Mr. Cargill and his companion, and presently sent information to Middleton, governor of Blackness Castle, who was a papist. After consultation, he immediately took the scent after them, ordering his soldiers to follow him at a distance by twos and threes together at convenient intervals to avoid suspicion, while he and his man rode up after them at some distance till they came to Queensferry, where, perceiving the house where they alighted, he sent his servant off in haste for his men, putting up his horse in another house, and coming to the house to them as a stranger, pretended a great deal of kindness and civility to Mr. Cargill and him, desiring that they might have a glass of wine together. When each had taken a glass and were in some friendly conference, The governor, wearying that his men came not up, threw off the mask and laid hands on them, saying they were his prisoners, and commanded the people of the house in the king's name to assist. But they all refused, except one Thomas George, a waiter, who, by whose assistance he got the gate shut. In the meanwhile, Howhead, being a bold and brisk man, struggled hard with the governor until Cargill got off, and after the scuffle, as he was going off himself, having got clear of the governor, Thomas George struck him on the head with a carbine and wounded him mortally. However, he got out, and by this time the women of the town, who were assembled at the gate to the rescue of the prisoners, convoyed him out of town. He walked some time on foot, but unable to speak much, save only some little reflection upon a woman who interposed, hindering him to kill the governor, that so he might have made his escape more timiously. At last he fainted and was carried to a country house near Ecklin, and although surgeons were speedily brought, yet he never recovered the use of his speech any more. Dalziel, living nearby, was soon advertised, and came quickly with a parley of the guards and seized him. And although every one saw the gentleman just a-dying, yet such was his inhumanity that he must carry him to Edinburgh. But he died in their hands on the way thither, and made an end of this his earthly pilgrimage to receive his heavenly crown. His corpse was carried to the Canongate tollbooth, where they lay 3 days without burial, and then his friends convened for that end to do their last office to him, yet that could not be granted. At last they caused bury him clandestinely in the night, for such was the fury of these limbs of Antichrist that after they had slain the witnesses they would not suffer them to be decently interred in the earth, which is another lasting evidence of the cruelty of those times. Thus the worthy gentleman, after he had in an eminent manner served his day and generation, fell a victim to prelatic fury. Upon him was found, when he was taken, a rude draft of an unsubscribed paper, afterwards called the Queensferry paper, which the reader will find inserted at large in Woodrow's History, Volume 2, Appendix Number 46, the substance of which is contained in Cruikshank's History and in the appendix to the Cloud of Witnesses. And the Cloud of Witnesses is available from Stillwaters. The Life of Mr. Richard Cameron. Mr. Richard Cameron was born in Falkland, in Shire of Fife, his father being a merchant there. He was of the episcopal persuasion at first, for, after he had passed his course of learning, he was sometimes schoolmaster and precentor to the curate of Falkland. He sometimes attended the sermons of the indulged as he had opportunity, but at last it pleased the Lord to incline him to go out to hear the persecuted gospel in the fields, which, when the curates understood, they set upon him, partly by flattery and partly by threats, and at the last, by more direct persecution, to make him forbear attending these meetings. But such was the wonderful working of the Lord by his powerful Spirit upon him, that having got a lively discovery of the sin and hazard of prelacy, he deserted the curates altogether, and no sooner was he enlightened anent the evil of prelacy, but he began more narrowly to search into the state of things, that he might know what was his proper and necessary duty. The Lord was pleased to discover to him the sinfulness of the indulgence as flowing from the ecclesiastical supremacy usurped by the king, and, being zealously affected for the honor of Christ, wronged by that Erastian acknowledgment of the magistrate's usurped power over the church, he longed for an opportunity to give a testimony against it. This made him leave Falkland and go to Sir Walter Scott of Harden, who attended the indulged meetings. Here he took the opportunity, notwithstanding of many strong temptations to the contrary, to witness in his station against the indulgence. Particularly on Sabbath, when called to attend the lady to church, he returned from the entry, refusing to go that day, and spent it in his chamber, where he met with much of the Lord's presence, as he himself afterwards testified, and got very evident discoveries of the nature of these temptations and suggestions of Satan, which were like to prevail with him before. And upon Monday, giving a reason unto the said Sir William and his lady, why he went not to church with them, he took occasion to be plain and express in testifying against the indulgence, in the original rise, spring, and complex nature thereof. After which, finding his service would be no longer acceptable to them, he went to the south, where he met with the Reverend Mr. John Welch. He stayed some time in his company, who, finding him a man every way qualified for the ministry, pressed him to accept a license to preach, which he for some time refused, chiefly upon the account that having such clear discoveries of the sinfulness of the indulgence, he could not but testify against it explicitly, so soon as he should have opportunity to preach the gospel in public, and so on. But the force of his objections being answered by Mr. Welch's serious solicitations, he was prevailed on to accept of a license from the outed ministers, who were then preaching in the fields, and had not then complied with the indulgence. Accordingly, he was licensed by Mr. Welch and Mr. Semple at Howhead, in Teviotdale, at the house of Henry Hall. Here, he told them, he would be a bone of contention among them, for if he preached against a national sin among them, it should be against the indulgences, and for separation from the indulged. After he was licensed, they sent him at first to preach in Annandale. He said how could he go there, he knew not what sort of people they were. But Mr. Welch said, "Go your way, Richie, and set the fire of hell to their tail." He went, and, the first day, he preached upon that text, "How shall I put thee among the children?" and so forth. In the application, he said, "Put you amongst the children, the offspring of robbers and thieves." Many have heard of Annandale thieves. Some of them got a merciful cast that day and told it afterwards, that it was the first field meeting that ever they attended, and that they went out of curiosity to see how a minister could preach in a tent and people sit on the ground. After this, he preached several times with Mr. Welch, Mr. Semple, and others, until 1679, that he and Mr. Wellwood were called before that Erastian meeting at Edinburgh in order to be deposed for their freedom and faithfulness in preaching against the sinful compliance of that time. After this, he preached at Maybole, where many thousands of people were assembled together, it being the first time that the sacrament of the Lord's Supper was then dispensed in the open fields. At this time, he used yet more freedom in testifying against the sinfulness of the indulgences, for which he was also called before another meeting of the indulged at Dinna in Galloway, and a little after that he was again called before a presbytery of them at Sundewall in Dunscore in Nithsdale, and this was the third time they had designed to take his license from him. Here it was where Robert Gray, a Northumberland man, who suffered afterwards in the grass market in 1682, Robert Nielsen and others protested against them for such a conduct. At this meeting they prevailed with him to give his promise that for some short time he should forbear such an explicit way of preaching against the indulgence and separation from them who were indulged, which promise lay heavy on him afterwards, as will appear in its own proper place. After the giving of this promise, finding himself by virtue thereof bound up from declaring the whole counsel of God, he turned a little melancholy, and to get the definite time of that unhappy promise exhausted, in the end of the year 1678 he went over to Holland, not knowing what work the Lord had for him there, where he conversed with Mr. McWard and others of our banished worthies. In his private conversation and exercise in families, but especially in his public sermon in the Scots Kirk of Rotterdam, he was most refreshing unto many souls, where he was most close upon conversion work from that text, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden," and so forth, and most satisfying and agreeable to Mr. McWard, Mr. Brown, and others, who were sadly misinformed by the indulged and those of their persuasion, that he could preach nothing but babble against the indulgence, cess-paying, and so forth. But here he touched upon none of those things, except in prayer, when lamenting over the deplorable case of Scotland by defection and tyranny. About this time Mr. McWard said to him, "Richard, the public standard is now fallen in Scotland, and if I know anything of the mind of the Lord, you are called to undergo your trials before us, and go home and lift the fallen standard, and display it publicly before the world. But before ye put your hand to it, ye shall go to as many as of the field ministers, for so they were yet called, as ye can find, and give them your hearty invitation to go with you. And if they will not go, go alone, and the Lord will go with you." Accordingly, he was ordained by Mr. McWard, Mr. Brown, and Rollman, a famous Dutch divine. When their hands were lifted up from his head, Mr. McWard continued his on his head, and cried out, "Behold, all ye beholders, here is the head of a faithful minister and servant of Jesus Christ, who shall lose the same for his master's interest, and shall be set up before sun and moon in the view of the world. In the beginning of the year 1680, he returned home to Scotland, where he spent some time in going from minister to minister of those who formerly kept up the public standard of the gospel in the fields, but all in vain, for the persecution being then so hot after Bothwell, against all such who had not accepted the indulgence and indemnity, none of them would adventure upon that hazard, except Mr. Donald Cargill and Mr. Thomas Douglas, who came together and kept a public fast day at Darmaid Muir, betwixt Clydesdale and Lothian, one of the chief causes of which was the reception of the Duke of York, that sworn vassal of Antichrist, unto Scotland, after he had been excluded from England and several other places. After several meetings among themselves, for forming a declaration and testimony which they were about to publish to the world, at last they agreed upon one, which they published at the Market Cross of Sanquhar, June 22, 1680, from which place it is commonly called the Sanquhar Declaration. After this they were obliged for some time to separate one from another and go to different corners of the land, and that not only upon the account of the urgent call and necessity of the people, who were then in a most starving condition with respect to the free and faithful preached gospel, but also on account of the indefatigable scrutiny of the enemy, who, for their better encouragement, had by proclamation 5,000 merks offered for apprehending Mr. Cameron, 3,000 for Mr. Cargill and Mr. Douglas, and 100 each for each of the rest, who were concerned in the publication of the aforesaid declaration. After parting, Mr. Cameron went to Swinenow in New Monkland, where he had a most confirming and comforting day upon that soul-refreshing text, Isaiah 31:2, "And a man shall be a hiding-place from the wind, and a covert from the tempest," and so on. In his preface that day, he said he was fully assured that the Lord, in mercy unto this church and nation, would sweep the throne of Britain of that unhappy race of the name Stuart, for their treachery, tyranny, and lechery, but especially their usurping the royal prerogatives of Christ, and this he was as sure of as his hands were upon that cloth, yea, and more sure, for he had that by sense, but the other by faith. Mr. H.E., who, how he says in a footnote, probably was Mr. Henry Erskine, the late Mr. Erskine's grandfather, who suffered much by imprisonment and other ways in this period, and though other ways a worthy good man, yet was so misled that having one time premeditated a sermon, wherein he intended to speak somewhat against Mr. Cameron and Mr. Cargill, so far was he from taking part with them. But on the Saturday's night he heard an audible voice which said twice unto him, "Audi." He answered, "Audio, I hear." The voice spoke again and said, "Beware of calling Cameron's words vain." This stopped him from his intended purpose. This he told himself afterwards unto an old reverend minister, who afterwards related the matter as above said. When he came to preach in and about Cumnock, he was much opposed by the lairds of Logan and Horseclue, who represented him as a Jesuit and a vile, naughty person. But yet some of the Lord's people, who had retained their former faithfulness, gave him a call to preach in that parish. When he began, he exhorted the people to mind that they were in the sight and presence of a holy God, and that all of them were hastening to an endless state of either well or woe. One Andrew Dalziel, a debauchee, a cocker or fowler, who was in the house, it being a stormy day, cried out, "Sir, we neither know you nor your God." Mr. Cameron, musing a little, said, "You, and all who do not know my God in mercy, shall know him in his judgments, which shall be sudden and surprising in a few days upon you, and I, as a sent servant of Jesus Christ, whose commission I bear, and whose badge I wear upon my breast, give you warning, and leave you to the justice of God." Accordingly, in a few days after, the said Andrew, being in perfect health, took his breakfast plentifully, and before he rose, fell a-vomiting, and vomited his heart's blood in the very vessel out of which he had taken his breakfast, and died in a most frightful manner. This admonishing passage, together with the power and presence of the Lord going along with the gospel dispensed by him, during the little time he was there, made the aforesaid two lairds desire a conference with him, which he readily assented to. after which they were obliged to acknowledge that they had been in the wrong to him and desired his forgiveness. He said from his heart he forgave them what wrongs they had done to him, but for what wrongs they had done to the interest of Christ, it was not his part, but he was persuaded that they would be remarkably punished for it. And to the Laird of Logan he said that he should be written childless, and to Horseclue that he should suffer by burning, both of which came afterwards to pass. Upon the 4th of July following, being 18 days before his death, he preached at the Grasswater side near Cumnock. In his preface that day he said, "There are three or four things I have to tell you this day, which I must not omit, because I will be but a breakfast or 4 hours to the enemy, some day or other shortly, and then my work and my time shall be finished both. And the first is this, as for King Charles II, who is now upon the throne of Britain, after him there shall not be crowned a king of the name of Stuart in Scotland," and how he notes in a footnote that King James II, that is the Duke of York, never took the coronation oath of Scotland. "Secondly, there shall not be an old covenanter's head above ground that swore these covenants with uplifted hands ere ye get a right reformation set up in Scotland. Thirdly, a man shall ride a day's journey in the shires of Galloway, Ayr, and Clydesdale, and not see a reeking house nor hear a cock crow ere ye get a right reformation, and several other shires shall be little better. And fourthly, the rod that the Lord will make instrumental in this will be the French and other foreigners, together with a party in this land joining them. But ye that stand to the testimony in that day, be not discouraged at the fewness of your number, for when Christ comes to raise up his own work in Scotland, he will not want men enough to work for him," and so on. In the week following, he preached in the parish of Carluke upon these words, Isaiah 40, verse 24, "Shall the prey be taken from the mighty?" and so on. And the Sabbath following, at Hindbottom, near Crawford John, he preached on these words, "Ye will not come to me that you may have life." In the time of which sermon he fell a-weeping, and the greater part of the multitude also, so that there were few dry cheeks to be seen among them. After this, unto the day of his death, he mostly kept his chamber door shut until night, for the mistress of the house where he stayed, having been several times at the door, got no access. At last she forced it up and found him very melancholy. She earnestly desired to know how it was with him. He said, "That weary promise I gave to these ministers has lain heavy upon me, and for which my carcass shall dung the wilderness, and that ere it be long." Being now near his end, he had such a large earnest of the Spirit, which made him have such a longing desire for full possession of the heavenly inheritance, that he seldom prayed in a family, asked a blessing, or gave thanks, but he requested patience to wait until the Lord's appointed time came. His last Sabbath he preached with Mr. Cargill in Clydesdale on Psalm 46:10, "Be still and know that I am God," and so forth. That day he said he was sure that the Lord would lift up a standard against Antichrist that would go to the gates of Rome and burn it with fire, and that blood should be their sign and no quarter their word, and earnestly wished that it might begin in Scotland. At their parting they concluded to meet the second Sabbath after this at Craigmead, but he was killed on the Thursday thereafter. And the Sabbath following, Mr. Cargill preached in the parish of the Shotts upon that text, "Know ye not that there is a great man and prince fallen this day in Israel?" The last night of his life he was in the house of William Mitchell in Meadowhead, at the Water of Ayr, where about 23 horse and 40 foot had continued with him that week. That morning a woman gave him water to wash his face and hands, and having washed and dried them with a towel, he looked to his hands and laid them on his face, saying, "This is their last washing. I have need to make them clean, for there are many to see them." At this the woman's mother wept. He said, "Weep not for me, but for yourself and yours, and for the sins of a sinful land, for ye have many melancholy, sorrowful, and weary days before you." The people who remained with him were in some hesitation whether they should abide together for their own defense or disperse and shift for themselves. But that day, being the 22nd of July, they were surprised by Bruce of Earlshall, who, having got command of Airlie's troops and Strahan's dragoons, upon notice given him by Sir John Cochrane of Ochiltree, and how he says in a footnote, "It was said Earlshall got £500 and Ochiltree 10,000 merks, However, some time after, one morning about break of day, a fiery pillar of a bloody color, seemingly about 2 yards long, was seen hanging above that house. The same day, about 2 o'clock afternoon, the castle took fire, and was, with charters, plate, and all, burnt down to the ground. The son said to the father, while it was burning, "This is the vengeance of Cameron's blood. That house was never built. For the new house, estate and all, they are gone from that race to others." Returning to the text, again, upon notice given him by Sir John Cochrane of Ochiltree, came furiously upon them about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when lying on the east end of Ayresmoss. When they saw the enemy approaching, and no possibility of escaping, they all gathered round about him, while he prayed a short word, wherein he repeated this expression thrice over, "Lord, spare the green and take the ripe." When ended, he said to his brother, with great intrepidity, "Come, let us fight it out to the last, for this is the day that I have longed for, and the day that I have prayed for, to die fighting against our Lord's avowed enemies. This is the day that we will get the crown." And to the rest he said, "Be encouraged, all of you, to fight it out valiantly, for all of you that shall fall this day, I see heaven's gates open to receive you." But the enemy approaching, they immediately drew up 8 horse with him on the right, the rest with valiant Haxton on the left, and the foot in the middle, where they all behaved with much bravery until overpowered by a superior number. At last Haxton was taken prisoner, as will afterwards be more fully narrated, and Mr. Cameron was killed on the spot, and his head and hands cut off by one Murray, and taken to Edinburgh. His father, being in prison for the same cause, they carried them to him, to add grief unto his former sorrow, and inquired at him if he knew them. He took his son's hands and head, which were very fair, being a man of a fair complexion, with his own hair, and kissed them, and said, I know them. They are my sons, my own dear sons. It is the Lord, good is the will of the Lord, who cannot wrong me nor mine, but has made goodness and mercy to follow us all our days. After which, by order of the council, his head was fixed upon the Netherbow port, and his hands beside it, with the fingers upward. Thus this valiant soldier and minister of Jesus Christ came to his end, after he had been not only highly instrumental in turning many souls unto God, but also in lifting up a faithful standard for his royal Lord and Master, against all his enemies, and the defections and sinful compliances of that time. One of his and Christ's declared enemies, when he took out his head at Edinburgh, gave him this testimony, saying, "There the head and hands of a man who lived praying and preaching, and died praying and fighting." And wherever the faithful contendings of the once famous covenanted Church of Scotland are honorably made mention of, this, to his honor, shall be recorded of him. When he was slain, there was found upon him a short paper, or bond of mutual defense, which the reader will find inserted in Woodrow's history, and in the appendix to the Cloud of Witnesses. There are also some few of his letters now published with Mr. Rennick's collection of letters, but the only sermon of his that appeared in print formerly is that preached at Carluke, entitled Good News to Scotland, published in the year 1733. He wrote also in defense of the Sanquhar Declaration, but we can give no account of it ever being published. Some more of his sermons were lately published. And here's an acrostic on his name, the acrostic being Master Richard Cameron, and reads as follows. "Most noble Cameron of renown, a fame of thee shall ne'er go down, since truth with zeal thou didst pursue, to Zion's king loyal and true. Even when the dragon spewed his flood, resist thou didst unto the blood, ran swiftly in thy Christian race, in faith and patience to that place, Christ did prepare to such as thee, he knew would not his standard flee. A pattern of valor and zeal, rather to suffer than to fail, did show thyself with might and main, counting that dross others thought gain. A faithful witness gainst all those men of all sorts did truth oppose. Even thou with Moses didst esteem reproaches for the God of heaven. On him alone thou didst rely, not sparing for his cause to die." The Life of David Haxton of Rathillet. David Haxton of Rathalet, in the Shire of Fife, is said in his younger years to have been without the least sense of anything religious, until it pleased the Lord in his infinite goodness to incline him to go out and attend the gospel then preached in the fields, where he was caught in the gospel net and became such a true convert that, after a most mature deliberation upon the controverted points of the principles of religion in that period, he at last embarked himself in that noble cause for which he afterwards suffered, with a full resolution to stand and fall with the despised, persecuted people, cause, and interest of Jesus Christ. There is no account of any public appearance that this worthy gentleman made amongst that party until the 3rd of May, 1679, that we find him, with other eight gentlemen, who were in quest of one Carmichael, who, by means of the Archbishop, had got commission to harass and persecute all he could find in the Shire of Fife for nonconformity. But not finding him, when they were ready to drop the search, they providentially met with their archenemy himself. Whenever they descried his coach, one of them said, "It seems that the Lord hath delivered him into our hand," and proposed that they should choose one for their leader, whose orders the rest were to obey. Upon which they chose David Haxton for their commander, but he absolutely refused, upon account of a difference subsisting betwixt Sharp and him in a civil process, wherein he judged himself to have been wronged by the primate, which deed he thought would give the world ground to think it was rather out of personal pique and revenge, which he professed he was free of. They then chose another, and came up with the coach, and having got the bishop out, and given him some words, he fell on the ground. They ordered him to pray, but instead of that, seeing Rathalet, at some distance, having never alighted from his horse, he crept towards him on his hands and his feet, and said, "Sir, I know you are a gentleman. You will protect me." To which he answered, "I shall never lay a hand on you." At last he was killed, after which everyone judged of the actions as their inclinations moved them. However, the deed was wholly charged upon him and his brother-in-law, Balfour of Kinloch, although he had no active hand in this action. About the latter end of the same month of May, that he might not be found wanting in the Lord's cause, interest, and people, upon any emergent occasion, he, with some friends from Fife, joined that suffering handful of the Covenanters at Evandale, where, after he and Mr. Hamilton and so forth had drawn up that declaration, afterwards called the Rutherglen Declaration, he and Mr. Douglas went to the Market Cross of Rutherglen, and upon the anniversary day, the 29th of May, where they extinguished the bonfires and published the said testimony. They returned back to Evandale, where they were attacked by Claverhouse upon the 1st of June near Drumclog. Here Mr. Haxton was appointed one of the commanding officers under Mr. Hamilton, who commanded in chief, where he behaved with much valor and gallantry during that skirmish, after which he was a very useful instrument among that faithful remnant, as witness his repeated protests against the corrupt and Erastian party, and had an active hand in the most part of the public transactions among them, until that fatal day, the 22nd of June, where he and his troop of horse were the last upon the field of the battle at Bothell Bridge. But this worthy and religious gentleman, being now declared a rebel to the king, though no rebel to Zion's king, and a proclamation issued out, wherein was a reward offered of 10,000 merks to any who could inform of or apprehend him, or any of those concerned in the death of the Archbishop of St. Andrews. Upon this and the proclamation after Bothell, he was obliged to retire out of the way for about a year's space, in which time he did not neglect to attend the gospel in the fields, wherever he could have it faithfully dispensed. But this pious gentleman, having run fast and done much in a little time, it could not be expected he should continue long, and upon the 22nd of July, 1680, having been with that little party a few days who attended Mr. Richard Cameron at Ayresmoss, they were surprised by Bruce of Earlshall, Airlie's troop, and Strahan's dragoons. This concludes Tape 12 of John Howie's Biographia Scoticana, or The Scots Worthies, the 1781 edition. This work is available from Stillwater's Revival Books, along with a treasure trove of the finest Protestant, Reformed, and Puritan literature available anywhere in the world today. Stillwater's may be reached at 780-450-3730, or by email at swrb@swrb.com. Stillwater's website is www.swrb.com and contains numerous free books and articles. Please note again that these tapes are not copyrighted, and we therefore encourage you to copy and distribute them to any and all you believe would be benefited.